Grab your walking shoes and clean out your ears. It's time for The Acoustic Pedestrian. Hi, everybody, and welcome to the show. Today's episode is about a subject that's near and dear to my heart, reading and literacy. The ability to read is something that we too often take for granted. And believe me, if you can't read, for whatever reason, you find out how much you're missing when you can read once again. It is a very moving experience, one that I will share with you and my guest today. More coming up right after this.
Welcome to the program. My guest today is Elka Bruton, and she works for the Oregon State Library's Talking Book Program. Hi, Elka. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
So the reason that we are talking today is because the Talking Book Program is hugely helpful for people like me. I spent about 7 years of my life, some time back, not being able to read things like books or magazines. And suddenly, knowing the perspective between not reading and reading and how it can bring people together really inspired me, and I want to call attention to this program and make sure people know just how easy it is to receive these very helpful services. So, Elka, tell us a little bit about Talking Books and what you do and maybe how you came to do it.
Sure. So every state has a Talking Books library. We're all sister libraries that derived out of the National Library Service for the Blind and Handicapped through the Library of Congress. Our libraries across the country make sure that people who are print disabled, so that can be anybody who has any disability that prevents them from holding a book, turning the pages, sitting up, seeing the book, or even understanding the printed word can access the library. We are not new at this. We've been doing it since 1931.
Wow, yeah, you're coming up on a big anniversary here pretty soon.
Right, yeah.
What kinds of services are available through the Talking Book program?
The basic services that are available are audiobooks. We have over 90,000 titles available, and we grow by about 500 or 600 new titles every month. And then we also have access to Braille, about 30,000 titles in Braille, which also grows every month. And then additionally to the physical books in Braille or audio, we also have full electronic access to all of the audiobooks. And so that means using an app or downloading the books yourself, and also access to most of the Braille books in their digital format. So for anyone who's using a refreshable Braille display, they can actually download the Braille files onto their display. A person can have an entire Braille book that would normally in print be like 15 volumes. They can have it all right there in their small, refreshable display at their fingertips.
I know this has been an ongoing process. Originally, these books were on flexible disc, very low-speed LPs, for those of you who remember what LPs are. And then they went to cassette and then upgraded to digital. When did the digital conversion finish?
So the full conversion just finished a few years ago. They started recording in digital around 2005. The first actual digital books, though, hit our shelves in 2009, and the entire collection, meaning the original collection that was still on tape, was finally completely converted as of last December. It was a multi-year process. They kind of hacked away at it a little bit at a time, doing about 200 or 300 of the what we called the retrospective collection. They would do 200 or 300 of those titles. Put them into digital format, and then get them onto the digital cartridges.
And that was, as you say, that was a huge thing because you didn't have to wait for physical media to come in the mail, although that still happens.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't need, like you say, a big Braille book or cassettes. You could just, I spend a fair amount of time perusing the online catalog
right.
for Library of Congress, just downloading books. I have... You know, there are apps for that, both for desktop and mobile devices. And so I have a personal library, which is kind of nice. And I don't have to wait for stuff to come in the mail, although it is fun when new books arrive in the mail. Those are often random titles, which is a service mm-hmm. that you can mm-hmm. opt in for.
Yeah, and I'm actually really glad that you said that about having your own library, because what was really significant that sighted people take for granted is that when the collection was converted to digital, when they began converting it, of course, at first they were just making it digital. They wanted a media that was going to last longer than the analog cassettes lasted. Analog cassettes could only circulate a few hundred times before they would break down. Once they started putting it on digital, they realized, well, if it's going to live on a server out in Washington, D.C., as people's internet connections got better, as their internet savvy and device savviness got better, they realized, why not open this up for the users, by using, a special login and password to give them access. And then they even broadened that and said, when people download these books, because we're not governed by normal copyright laws, they said the people who can use this library can begin creating their own personal libraries if they have the inclination and the digital space to store it. And that was amazing, because a sighted person can just go down to the local bookstore and they can buy their battered copy of The Martian Chronicles for $5 and they can put it on their shelf and keep it forever. But for people who use the audiobooks or the Braille books from us, from the Library of Congress, those are federal property. They weren't created commercially. So even if a person had the financial means to purchase those materials, they could not purchase them. So people who were print disabled couldn't have their favorite copies or their favorite authors or their favorite series on their shelf. They had to read it once, send it back, and they could only read it again when they called and borrowed that book again. Being able to access the digital collection really gave our readers freedom that they had truly since the library began had never had before.
And the other nice thing is that because we're talking about digital media, if you don't have the storage space or the inclination to create your own personal library, you can always re-download the files from the library server anytime you want.
That's right. Yeah, anytime. And this also gave our users, those who have the ability to access us digitally, it also gave them their privacy. In traditional library service, we always talk about how our readers deserve their privacy. They deserve to read what they want. In fact, a traditional library will not submit records of readers, even with subpoena, they will not submit those records. Part of the way they do that is they do not keep track of what their readers read, so that they don't even have a record to submit. Because a traditional reader can walk into a library completely privately, pull a book off the shelf, you can go, you check it out, nobody judges you, nobody asks you questions. Our readers, since the beginning of time, have always had to use some sort of intermediary. We do our best to maintain privacy for our users. We always respect their wants, needs. We never question their reading choices. But by having that collection in digital for those people who wanted to and could, they could truly have a private interaction with the library and not have to go through an intermedia on the phone or via email to request a book that they might not be comfortable sharing with someone else.
You hear it a lot in disability circles, whatever disability you discuss, that there is that intermediary, that agent, someone that the individual has to work with. And some agencies get very paternalistic and say, well, we know what you need and you don't. And so this is a small but extremely significant piece of freedom, like you say, that you get to read whatever you want. Another positive of that I have taken a lot of advantage of is because you can subscribe to one of the channels, if you will, for books that get mailed, is random selections, which is fun. I have discovered all sorts of authors this way.
Right. Yeah, we have a really highly complicated system in the background where we tag every title gets tagged with certain things like romance, mysteries, biographies, whatever subjects that book seems to touch, I tag the title with that. And then conversely, the patron, the user then tells me, I want mysteries that take place in England, I want romances, but I don't like stories about science fiction or vampires. And so I can plug that into their particular profile, and then, yes, the system does. It goes in. It looks for the things that match their interests. It takes out anything that what we call an exclusion, that it's excluded from their account. And then, ideally, it's gonna spit out two or three books that really do match that person's interests. And what I like about the automatic selection especially is, once again, going back to a traditional reader, most of us walk into a public library, and unless we're there for a very specific purpose, we're here to get the latest Daniel Steele, we're here to research, tax law or something like that in our area, most of us walk into the public library and just kind of browse. I don't know what I'm in the mood for. Let's see what's new. Our users, being at their homes, getting books by mail, aren't any different, except they're even more isolated, saying, I don't know what I want. I don't know what you have. How do I know what to read? And so it's really nice to be able to send those random selections based on their subjects. It keeps people interested. It gives them neat things, but it also will turn you on to authors, subjects, or book series that you didn't know existed. Turns out you find your next favorite author that way. So that can be really cool.
Very much so. And like I say, I've had a number of authors and series come to me that way. And what's interesting with the digital interface, the apps that are available, is you can now actually browse the collection and say, I want a book, I want to look at fiction books that include submarines. And it shows up. There are a few fiction books that include submarines.
That's right.
Copyright has always been a question, and I believe it was President Clinton who signed legislation that streamlined the alternative media process.
The Pratt-Smoot Act of 1931 is what created our library, and what in that law, that act also included the original information about copyright, and it said basically that You know, it named our formats back then, which at that point was only Braille in 1931. We didn't have audio yet. And so it named those very specific media that said, as long as we were using this media for people who qualify, we did not have to abide by the regular copyright law, which means that we can make a formatted book in of anything as long as we're sharing it only with people who qualify. And it also means, and this is really significant, that we can make copies of that book once we've put it into a format. We can make copies at will. As the years went by and the media changed, of course, they did have to update the law to include the different media, the audio, the tapes, the digital, things like that, so that we could continue to run. So I do know that somewhere right around the 91, 92, it was kind of re-ratified, re-signed with some of that new language.
Maybe I heard this incorrectly originally, that there was a really big sort of lag between the time a new book was published and when it found its way into alternate media. Was copyright a factor in that process?
No, not at all. It simply came down to how long it took the Library of Congress, the National Library Service, to create those copies. So if you just take audio, for instance, before we were digital, so, you know, before 2005, the books were recorded. They've always been recorded by professional narrators, so it was always a real person recording the books, but they were recorded on tape, and so they basically ran through that book plain, you know, they just kind of ran through it raw, without any kind of practice. They did their best. When the book, if there were errors in the book, the tape, you know, is some of us who've ever messed around with analog tape remember, you had to physically splice the tape and fix it. So then it had to go to post-production. It had to be, checked over. They had to re-record anything that was wrong. Once it was done like that, it truly had to go to another factory and get put on these tapes. The tapes were created, the boxes were created, etc. Once digital came along and they got good at it, they were able to, you know, develop some new processes for this. That was shortened tremendously. It used to be roughly a 6-month lag between when a book came out in print, because the National Library Service would have to go and buy that book. They'd have to go down the street, you know, pick up that book at a bookstore and then record it. Once they got better at it, once digital came along, they were able to record digitally, so they could actually make corrections on the fly. You didn't have to wait to, to review and fix it if you coughed or if you stumbled over a sentence or missed a paragraph. So they could do it much quicker, correct it as they went. It was then able to go to post-production sooner, and when they put it onto the digital cartridges, instead of having multiple tapes, they were able to put the entire book on a single cartridge. So no longer did they have to say, okay, we've got volume 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Everything went on one. And since 2005, we've shortened production. They've shortened production from the 6 months to roughly 90 days is the normal now to get a book from when it comes out. Of course, now books are coming out. When books are published, they're coming out in digital formats much sooner. So in some of these instances, they're not even having to wait for the print. They're able to get a hold of the digital format, like the ebook style digital format much sooner, and use that to record. And then the National Library Service has also made some really great partnerships with some of the top commercial audio producers, where they're bundling their titles, and for a very tiny amount of money, we're talking something like $1 a title, they're able to buy large bundles of commercial, which then is cutting. There's no more production time. It's the book's ready. Blackstone Audio, you know, created it at the same time that the paper style, the printed book, came out, and we're getting it within a few weeks of that launch and getting it out and having it on the digital on the server for people to download right away, and then in physical format for our users who get books by mail within just a couple of weeks.
And I think that's very important. And like you say, the commercial audiobooks have jumped in there too. That something we forget, again, is sort of that isolation if you have to wait 6 months or more to read the latest and greatest title, you're out of touch with your friends, your compatriots, whatever.
Right.
And now, really, that lag is almost gone.
It's almost gone. And what's great, and the National Library Service has done this for, several years. I don't know. I've been with the library for a dozen years, and I know that they've done it ever since then. But their collection team out there in D.C. pays attention to what is a big deal, what's coming out, what people are waiting for. And if you think about the, recently there have been a lot of high-profile political memoirs and biographies that have come out. And, of course, those of us reading print, we hear about it on the news. We know it's coming out. We can't wait till that book comes out. Well, our collection team at the National Library Service, they're on top of it already as well, and they're already working with whoever they need to get that commercial audio or get that book and be reading it, narrating it the day it comes out so that they can have it in rush production so that it's on our shelves within just a week. And once again, the minute a book is vetted, once it's recorded, whether it's Braille or audio, it immediately goes on the server. So there's no lag time. Once it's been approved, it goes on to the download site right away.
Are there local book clubs, I guess, that work within the Talking Book system?
I'm glad you asked that. So we support book clubs, book groups, community-wide reading programs by encouraging our users to get back involved with their communities, because of course we want to support our users first, but we also want to support all of our local communities here in Oregon and our local libraries, our community libraries. And so what we do is we encourage the public libraries to get in touch with us, but we also pay attention to what they're doing. And so when we find out that Multnomah County is doing their Everybody Reads event, they always announce that months in advance. We make sure that we have that title available. We contact everyone who is a user of ours in their service area, and we let them know, hey, your public library, everyone's going to read this book. The event's going to start in February. Here's a link back to the website where they're going to have their, maybe the author's going to come and visit. They're going to have book discussion. They might have, art projects or community things going on at the library. And then we say to our users, call us for the book because we'll have the title so you don't have to wait for it, because of course the public library probably has about a dozen copies in audio and they share their audio with every user no matter their abilities. And so we say, get your book from us so that you don't have to wait. That's where our freedom to create copies at will comes in, because maybe normally we only have a couple of copies of that book, but we send the letter out, we maybe get 80 different responses. We will put 80 copies of that book in the mail. We don't make any of those patrons wait for their copy. And then we encourage them to get back in with their public library, go visit the library, go take part in their community, and be a part of things. And we do the same thing with any, assisted living facilities, if they're having a book club, if just someone in just within their little community is having a book club. We want our users to, ideally we want our users to go and be physically a part of their community, but we also know that it's just as important to feel like you're a part of your community. So even if one of our readers finds out about Multnomah, they know that book is being read, but they don't have a ride to the library, or they're not the type of person who's very social and doesn't necessarily want to go into a social setting. We still want them to feel like they're being a part of something, even if it's private, even if they don't, technically share that with anyone. We think it's just important for them to be a part of the experience in their own way, whatever way they feel comfortable.
And I think that's tremendously important for the reasons you said, and also because books in general, the idea of everybody reading a book, books are about ideas. Words are just the tool we use to express them. And if you have some disability, it doesn't particularly matter which one, you are isolated. Sometimes people forget that you have feelings and ideas, even though you can't hold a book in your hand for whatever reason. You can still take in that content, and you can still process it, and you can react to it.
Right.
And that's what brings people together, and getting people into the same place is very useful because we have interactions that aren't limited. When we use technology, we can't always hear everything, or we can't see things, or we can't even smell the cheeseburger somebody had for lunch before they came to book club. But we share these ideas, and I think that's important. I also think it's vitally important to the intellectual well-being of our society that books are, I guess you could consider it long-form content still.
Mm-hmm.
When so many things are done in these tiny little capsules,
mm-hmm.
you know, a video that's 5 minutes long, someone thinks is too long.
Right.
And to take the time to read a book all the way through, even if it's a short book, it takes longer than 5 minutes, unless we're talking mm-hmm. about, you know, a book for maybe preschoolers. And so you do have to engage with this content, and you do have to give it more of your attention over a longer period. I think we need that.
Right.
So what other media is available through this program?
Through Oregon specifically, we also provide access to DVDs that have a descriptive audio track in them. So these are the same blockbuster movies, and some of them not so blockbuster. Maybe they just were critically acclaimed, that anyone can rent it at Redbox or you know, buy off of Amazon. But they have a descriptive audio track that describes the action of the movie when there's no dialogue going on. So if you, the next time you're watching a movie, you know, close your eyes. When no one's talking and there aren't, there aren't real audio cues going on, you realize you have no idea what's happening. When the woman screams or a dog barks, you don't know what's happening or why someone's reacting. These videos with the descriptive audio track explain, you know, the woman is walking to her car, it's very late, it's dark, one of the street lights has gone out, she seems concerned. And what's nice about the way that the narration goes is that it's very unobtrusive. Most people who are sighted, who watch with friends or family members, say that they actually prefer it, and that after a while they realize that they don't even realize what they're hearing. It's just part of the experience. But for someone who has limited sight or is not sighted, it makes it really easy to follow along and once again share that experience of the movie and what's happening to be able to enjoy the movie. And what a lot of people do not realize is that all of these videos, the DVDs that we have and circulate, these are all commercially available DVDs. We buy ours off of Amazon just because that's where we seem to get the best price. But these are the same DVDs that you would buy at the store, on Amazon, online, or even borrow at Redbox. Several of these production companies are making descriptive audio tracks a part of their videos, of their movies, from the very beginning. And it's found in the language portion of the on the DVD. So if you flip that DVD over, it'll say languages, it'll say, you know, English, Spanish, maybe it'll say French, and then you're going to look for the letters DVS for descriptive video service. And so many movies are already have descriptive tracks, and you don't even know it. They're already in your collection.
I've been a big James Bond fan for a long time, and the last two or three films I've given up on without DVS because I think I timed one, and there were like 36 minutes of this film with 5 words of dialogue in it.
Wow.
And it's crazy. And
right.
We are seeing a huge upswing right now in action movies.
Yeah.
And those are, they're very exciting if you can see them, but mm-hmm. otherwise they're really extremely boring.
Yes. and on that note, the Marvel Universe, I'm a big Disney fan and Marvel fan. All Disney movies and new Marvel movies in the last 3 or 4 years are all DVS, descriptive video. So our collection, we've got Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, we have Thor, we've got Coco, you know, we've got all these movies that are, you know, part action, part animation, which also can, you know, sometimes not necessarily have dialogue that corresponds with what might be seen on the screen. And so there are a lot of these production companies that are making it the norm. It's not the exception, it is the rule. Anything they do is coming out with descriptive video, and the more they do it, the more their competitors begin to do it as well. So it's, you know, we all win. It's great for everyone.
Which is cool. And unfortunately, I think probably the reason that this is happening is more what you said earlier, that sighted people are just as happy with this audio track as well. And while that disturbs me on principle, the result is good, and so we will take that.
Yeah, I've for a long time subscribed to the attitude that, you know, sometimes you can't bust right through the front door, but if you can find a way in through the window or the back door, you know what? If you get there, that works too. So
exactly.
I think that,
goal-oriented,
yeah,
ultimately, thinking.
Yes. and then I just wanted to add that with descriptive video, a lot of listeners might not know this, and maybe you've discussed it before, but any new Netflix original content now, as of, oh, roughly 3-4 years ago, all Netflix original content also has descriptive video ability, just right on Netflix, even in streaming when you're watching.
Wow, I did not know that. I am not a Netflix user, and so maybe I will be now.
It was really cool. They launched it several years ago when they redid the superhero one, and I always get it wrong. He is the sight-impaired superhero.
Daredevil,
thank you. Yes, when they did Daredevil, that was part of their launch, was they were like, we're doing a relaunch of Daredevil. This superhero is sight impaired. They were basically, you know, whoever it was that pointed it out to them, I mean, you know, bless them, because they went, you can't release a story about a sight impaired person that is not accessible for sight impaired people. And from when they did that, they just kind of went, and you know what? We should just do this with all of our content. So everything after that date has descriptive video, which I think, dang, that's really cool.
That's fantastic. You know, the thing that when I listen to descriptive video, the thing that strikes me so much is how hard it must be for the narrators.
Mm-hmm.
Because the language is, as you say, it is descriptive. It is not interpretive at all. It's very neutral in its intonation. No matter what is happening on the screen, the narration never gets excited or happy or sad. It's just describing the action.
Mm-hmm.
That would be hard.
Right, right. Yeah, I don't know what a day at work is like for the narrators. It must be pretty interesting. I hope, for their sake, I hope that they get a chance to watch the movie on their own first before they have to, you know, really jump in and, you know, because you kind of dissect it. It's like doing a close read of a novel. You're really just dissecting, you know, everything that's on the screen. So I hope they get a chance to enjoy it first before it becomes part of a day's work for them.
I wonder, you know, how is it like living at home with these people? Honey, what you did makes me angry, and I'm sad.
Yes. Yeah. So you had asked about some other services, and I got all nostalgic there about the descriptive video, but we also provide access to audio magazines, Braille magazines. We provide access to newspapers by phone. Our newspaper service is provided through the NFB, that's the National Federation for the Blind, and they partner with, here in Oregon, they partner with us. So we use donation money to fund part of it, and the Commission for the Blind pitches in the other third. And that provides access to magazines, or newspapers rather, from all over the country. It is available via telephone, toll-free phone number. People can access it on their smartphones, and it is up-to-the-minute news off of the wire. So it is a computer-generated voice, a virtual voice. It's very natural and lifelike, but it's the only thing we do in a computer-generated voice, and we do it. It's done that way in the interest of having the news be as as immediate and pertinent as possible rather than waiting for something to be recorded.
And I have to, again, say how tickled I am to be able to read magazines. I spent many years not being able to do that, and now I'm mm-hmm. a regular reader of several. And I find that I actually don't have time to read all the things I can read and I want to read, which is a really great place to be, actually.
Right.
So you mentioned donations. Obviously, this is a thing. So you're a state agency, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And so we're interesting. Yeah, we're a state agency. So we do get a budget approved by the legislature that is tax money. So all of us Oregon taxpayers, some of that money gets allocated to this library. We also we say that we are, you know, federally funded. No actual money changes hands here at the Oregon level, but those federal funds, so our federal tax money, pays for the talking book players, pays for the, you know, administration of the app and the servers and those books on cartridge. All of that's federal money. But the state legislature only allocates so much money to us here at the library, and the way that we provide things like anything that's not the books, so the descriptive videos, the newspapers by phone, Braille. So I shouldn't even say not the books, I should say not the audiobooks, because in Oregon, the legislature took out the funding that we used to pay for the Braille books. So that's all money that we get from patrons, friends, family of patrons, people who donate money to Talking Books. All that money goes back into serving our users with the, you know, newspapers, videos, you know, things like mailers if we need to buy paper to you know, send out notices, or if we need to buy additional cartridges to put the audio newsletter on. All of that comes from donation money.
And so I'm going to make the plug right here. If you are indeed a Talking Books user, when you get those nice letters in the mail that say, please donate, please donate. This helps everybody. And if folks who are not patrons of the Talking Book program would like to donate, how can they do that?
You can go onto our website. It is ortalkingbooks.org. It's all one word, or you could simply Google the, you know, Oregon Talking Books, and you will find our website. We're the first or second result that pops up depending on the day. And there's a button for donate to Talking Books. And once you click through that website, you can actually even specify where you want your money to go. You can say you want it to go to the large print calendars that we create every year. You can say that you want it to go to our endowment fund, which is money that we don't use. We put it in trust, and we at different times will spend the interest off of that money. So you can decide once you're online where you want the money to go. But all money is used back for our patrons to serve our patrons and users with our services and additional services.
And fear not, campers, because a link to that donation page will appear in the episode notes as always. Anything funny or strange or zany that comes to mind from your history with the Talking Book program?
I love to say some general history about us here. Some people think it's kind of interesting. So this library was started in 1931 nationally. Oregon was the eighth state to agree to partner. When the National Library Service first started, they realized right away that they were going to have to partner with individual libraries so that people could be served at home and not be served from, you know, Washington, D.C., far away. So we were the eighth state. We joined in 1932. From 32 to 69, the library was administered and lived at the Multnomah County Library, the downtown branch. And up until 1969, the law only provided for adult blind people to use the library. So kids were left out, people who had a physical disability were left out, and anyone with a learning disability was left out. And for years and years, lots of people, tens of thousands of people knew that we needed to serve children and we needed to serve people with physical disabilities and learning disabilities. And it was lawmaker Kennedy. I'm going to like be on the spot here and get all my names wrong, but I can remember Kennedy. He had gotten in a skiing accident and broken his legs, and he was laid up in bed for several weeks. And the one of his aides had a friend at the Library of Congress, at the National Library Service, and they said, "Hey, is there anything we can do? You know, he's bored. He needs books. I know you guys have these audio books." And the library director at the time was very savvy, very politically savvy, and they said, "You know, okay, yeah, the law doesn't provide for this, but, you know, on the sly, let me go ahead and send you some audio books for him to use." He began using them. He understood what a valuable necessity this was for people who were not only sight impaired. He realized how valuable it would be. And when he got well and went back, that director said, "You know, it'd be really great if we could serve other Americans who are physically disabled on a permanent basis or temporary, just like you." And within a couple of years, that's when we were able to open up two kids and to people of other disabilities, of other print disabilities. So if not for those broken legs and the ski accident, you know, who knows how long it would have taken us to fight. I mean, certainly once the ADA was passed, but you know how it is. It wasn't always that easy, and it wasn't always that obvious to people. So we do have that accident to thank for the ability to serve additional people with the library.
So would that have been Ted Kennedy?
Yes, thank you, Ted Kennedy. Yes, yes. And I always thought that was a really cool cool story, because a lot of us that are on the other side of civil rights, rights for people who have disabilities, you know, some of us were born after a time where some of these things were just assumed, and we weren't around when these things weren't assumed. And so I think it's really cool to look back and think, wow, that's ridiculous that we didn't serve people who were print disabled, regardless of the, you know, the reason that they had a print disability. And it took this little crazy happenstance and a very savvy director at the time who was like, kind of like a, you know, "I'll scratch your back if you can scratch ours," and thus open the library for millions of Americans.
Thanks to the late, great Ted Kennedy for breaking his leg in a skiing accident. And lots more people get to read now. So that brings up a really important point. Obviously, these services are available not just for blind people and not just for adults anymore. How do you sign up for these services if you need them?
Right. So the library tries to make it as easy as possible, because library service, and as we know, accessibilities and accessible things, accessible buildings, accessible any kind of accessible technology, it shouldn't be any more difficult to get a hold of that accessibility than it would be for a person who does not have a disability. So when you want to use the library, all you have to do is fill out an application or have someone help you fill that out. It is 4 pages in large print, so it looks like it's a lot more than, you know, it looks like there's a lot more to it than there is. It basically asks you, who are you and where do you want your books to go, assuming we're going to mail books to you. It asks you what kind of books you might be interested in to start off with. So it gives a few, gives about 20 broad subjects just to get people thinking and get them to start putting down their interests. It tells you about the extra services that the library has, so that you can opt in right away for some of those things like descriptive videos or, you know, the newspapers by phone. And then the last page is where the application is going to be certified. And we try to make this as easy and open as possible. You do not have to only have a doctor sign this application. The application for people who have a visual impairment or physical impairment can be signed by almost anyone who comes in contact with that person on a professional level. So it could be a social worker, a doctor, it could be a public librarian, a teacher. It could even be a pastor, so it's someone that knows that person and basically vouches for the print disability, the reason that they need to use the library. And we try to make it that way so that there are lots of people you come in contact with to get that application signed so that you don't necessarily have to make a special trip to your doctor's office, you know, and have to pay a copay or something like that. The application takes is the person to just fill out their name and where their address, like their, you know, practice it, let's say if it is a doctor or, you know, the public library, if it's the public librarian that signs the application. And then he or she just puts a signature down on that paper. We do not ask for any corresponding information, no, you know, diagnoses forms or anything like that. Once we receive that application with the signature, as long as everything is on the up and up and it is not a family member or just a name that doesn't seem to correspond with any kind of a professional capacity, then we pass that application on and we process it. And get materials in the person's hand within a couple of business days.
And that's really true. The couple of business days is absolutely true, campers. I was shocked at how quickly my application was processed, and suddenly I have books. And like I say, I had not been able to read a book for somewhere close to 7 years. And it was a very powerful moment to sit down and say, look, Mom, I'm reading again.
Right.
It was tremendous. I read more now than I did when I could see to read print.
Right. One of the things I love personally about audio is that you can be reading all the time, and so whether you're print disabled or not, reading usually in the traditional sense unprinted is something you have to do when you're sitting down stationary somewhere. You don't have anything else going on. You're reading a book. But with audio, if you're an audio reader, you can certainly be reading while you're doing other activities, while you're outside enjoying the sunshine, while you're, working on a project. So it actually really opens up the time and instances where a person can read even more.
That's very true. I usually read my favorite times to read are before I go to sleep, which I have done pretty much my whole life, print or no, and whenever I am commuting, since I take public transit everywhere, that's a lot of downtime that I spend with headphones bolted on my head, so I am reading pretty much. And it passes the time. It's great. The one thing that I want to stress, you mentioned it, and I want to make sure that people get this concept. You do not need to be certified. You do not, for example, need to be legally blind to take advantage of these services.
Correct. Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. Yes, sometimes people will call us and they'll say, I'm legally blind, can I use the library? And legal blindness and things like that have nothing to do with the determination for using this library. What we tell people, and we try to keep it as simple as possible, is if your disability, so let's take a visual disability, if your vision impairment that you have is just to a degree that it makes reading normal size print, and that would be your 12-point font, so normal print, if it makes that uncomfortable, then you would qualify to use the library. If you have a physical disability or illness that prevents you from sitting up, holding the book, turning the pages, so you might think about somebody who has Parkinson's, who has a tremor, and trying to hold a book and read would be an absolute nightmare. You know, reading is supposed to be about relaxing, engaging, expanding your mind. It's not supposed to be this stressful chore. So if your disability prevents you from accessing and reading what you want to read for the amount of time you want to read, then you qualify to use the library.
And that's huge. Before I was certified legally blind, because there was a time when I had normal sight, there is that sort of in-between no man's land where you don't qualify for pretty much anything, and yet sight loss is impacting your life in very significant ways. And so this was pretty much, I think the Talking Book program was the first major thing that came up that I actually could get services, and so it was very powerful the way that it did enrich my life at that time and continues to do so.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a you do have to qualify, but those qualifications are a lot simpler than people believe, and I hear that when I talk to folks and they ask, about this program, because I am always talking it up and say, oh, yes, talking books is great. And they say, well, I wouldn't qualify for that, especially older folks. And I say, yes, mm-hmm. you would.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I hear this all the time. Part of my job with the library is that I travel and I do presentations all around the state, pretty much to anyone who will invite me into their building. And to this day, after all these years, I still will hear a person who will say, I tried to get the library and my doctor said I didn't qualify. My doctor wouldn't sign the form. And that's where I really stress, then go to someone else who's listed on that form who can sign it for you. Call us and we'll give you some pointers of who to talk to. Because I tell people that, especially with vision impairment who have taken it to their eye doctor, I say, you know, your doctor is focused on cure and treatment. And so he or she doesn't want to sound doom and gloom. Well, I guess you're going to need this library that's audio because this treatment probably isn't going to work. Nobody wants to, you know, say, well, I guess if that's not going to work, you can use this. So sometimes, you know, your doctor, maybe just the way that you bring it to their attention, they may say, no, you don't need that yet. Don't worry about that. We're going to do this. But go with your instinct. You want to read. You deserve to read. The public libraries were created and proliferated so that anyone of any walk of life, whether it was socioeconomic or whether it was the color of their skin, the level of their education, the libraries are there so that we can all have the same opportunity to read and expand and be delighted and entertained. And so if your gut's telling you, I want this and I can't see or I can't read for very long, then keep fighting. And or, like I said, call us. We'd be happy to say, hey, you know, I know you're public librarian. Let me get you in touch with that person. Or you know, what about your pastor? Do you belong, you know, do you have a church community? Okay, take that application to that person and we'll get it filled out for you.
So you're not going to, you don't have a network of, you know, secret enforcers named Vinny who go to eye doctors.
No, I wish, but it's why I still have a job because, you know, every year I spend about 50% of my time traveling, knocking on doors, picking up the phone, you know, because I always tell people whenever I am in public, I always say my job is to create an information army. So while I might not be talking to the person that's going to use the library today, I might be talking to the person who's going to talk to a person next year, you know, who's going to remember and help connect them with the library. So, yeah. So I just keep hitting the pavement, trying to get that word out there, so that everybody knows that they can use the library.
Absolutely, and that's why we are talking today. And so I would like to offer an experiment to my listeners. If you'd like to know what this experience is like, try this. Mark off on your calendar 1 week, 7 whole days. Don't read a book or a magazine. Now, you probably have to do email and you have to do paperwork in your office and all that stuff, but do not read recreationally for a whole week. And then go back and read again. And imagine if someone were to tell you that week is going to be for the rest of your life. It is a huge turning point when people get their literacy back. Thanks to everybody at the National Library Service and Talking Books, state libraries across the country and around the world. I mean, these programs exist in other countries as well.
Correct.
For giving everybody who wants to read, like you say, the chance to read. Any advice, last words, secrets to, you know, the universal discount?
No, you know, we love to hear from our users. We enjoy helping you find materials. We are hoping to expand some of the way that we provide our library books to people in the near future. The National Library Service is working on things, for instance, in the future. We're really hoping that you'll be able to have your book on your device, which you have now, but we're hoping that soon you'll be able to tell that little Alexa device in your house to pick up that book where you left off so that your book can follow you from room to room. We're also working on creating, so instead of getting one book at a time for people who get books in the mail, we're working on adapting our technology so that we can do multiple books that are customized for each user to get multiple books on a single cartridge rather than waiting for so many things to come in the mail. And so all of it requires some hard work in the background and some technology upgrades, but those are some things that are coming down the way for our users.
Cool, very cool. And I did want to mention also, current library patrons, I'm sure, are aware of this. If you are considering signing up for the Talking Book Program, A, of course you should do it. B, one of the other reasons is the customer service is absolutely phenomenal. Particularly, I'm sure this is true in other states, but I can speak to the Oregon State Library's Talking Book Program. Anytime I need something, which is rare because the documentation is good, the technology delivery system is good, if I have a question or I need something, there's somebody there with an answer, and it's a human being with an answer that a human being can understand.
Yeah, you can reach us by phone or email. We treat both phone and email and voicemail as if you were a customer right here in our library. So we don't prioritize you differently. So you can, whatever format you choose to interact with us, we're here and we will talk to you, get back to you, take care of those problems. You know, if you're using a player and the player breaks, or you need your password reset for the Bard online download system, just let us know. We're here to help.
Very true. And I think the most important thing, and want to sort of wrap up with that, is to remind everybody that just like your local public library, these services are provided free of charge.
Yeah, absolutely free. Even if you lose a book, or your books are terribly overdue, or if your player is broken, or even, God forbid, stolen, there are no fees, there are no charges. If we have to mark some things lost out of your account, just talk to us. But we're never going to send you a note saying that you owe us, $25 in library fines at all. So it is really, truly a free library service for you to use.
So that's where Vinny would come in, though.
That's right. Yeah, we do have a fixer who goes out, and he may knock on your door, but we're never going to send you a letter asking for money.
Yeah. He'll say, those cartridges. Come back. Now, I have
That's
to say,
right.
I am not the world's most exemplary library patron, because sometimes I get very busy and I don't get to read all of my cartridge books as quickly as you're supposed to. The loan time is, 6 weeks?
It is 6 weeks. We don't technically count you as overdue for an additional 6 weeks. So we know that the books are going through the mail. Sometimes they can get hung up in the mail. They can be lost in the mail. So rather than waste both our users' time and our time, we wait an additional 6 weeks before we send out a notice if you have overdue materials. And then that notice is really just worded to say, hey, we think you have these books. If you do, please send them back. If you don't, call us. And I really can't stress that enough. If you get an overdue notice from us and you think, I don't have those books, the most important thing you can do is get back in touch with us and let us know, because we know things get lost in the mail. That allows us to clear those materials out of your account so that, one, you can get back to getting the books that you want, and two, it lets us know that we may have some missing books in our collection so that we can make more copies to share with other people. So it's super important just to give us that heads up and say, hey, I don't have those, or I did return those a long time ago. They must be lost. And we literally take your word for that. That's great, but we can't do it unless you let us know.
And I want to say that the overdue notices are very polite. There's no threat implied. It's exactly as you said. I know, because I just got one the other day. And so I did precisely what you're supposed to do. I went, oh, geez, I know where these books are. They're sitting in my book drawer because I haven't been reading cartridge books a lot. And so that says, okay, get off your butt and read some cartridge books and get caught up. So
yeah.
In case I need an impetus to read more, thank you.
You're welcome.
So I believe we are there. Elke Bruton from the Oregon State Library's Talking Book Program, thank you very much for sharing all of this information and trivia with us today.
Great. Thank you. I've had a great time. I love talking about this library.
Good. Job security for you then. So
absolutely.
Once again, look in the episode notes, everybody. You will find links to all sorts of different resources, including a sample of what these books sound like to those who read them through their ears. And now you get to stop listening to the podcast and go out and read a book, print or otherwise. right. Thanks again so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Jim. I really appreciate it.
And here we are at the end of the episode. Sorry, gang, there's no monster at the end of this book. Special thanks to my guest, Elka Bruton, for speaking with me from the Oregon State Library's Talking Book Program. See the episode notes for information about where you can learn more, where you can donate if you're in Oregon, or where you can contact your state library if you're in another state, like the one of confusion. Speaking of donations, you can always, of course, support the podcast through your donations. Go to the website, theacousticpedestrian.com. You can read about this episode, listen to other episodes, and support the podcast through your generous donations, either a one-time gift or an ongoing subscription through Patreon. Special thanks to patrons Laura and Bill and all our fans, past, present, and future, everywhere around the universe. Be sure to try the experiment I mentioned in the episode. It will help you appreciate just how important reading is. Until next time, enjoy all those stories. Remember to walk gently and keep listening.